here's the question formulated mathematically. The escape velocity, of course, satisfies 1/2 the mass of the gravitating object. M here stands for the mass of the gravitating object. I guess I should call it big M. 1/2 M times the escape velocity squared is equal to mg over r. Okay, that's it. That's this formula that they started with. Am I missing something? Let's see. No, I should. Yeah, little m. Little m. This should be. Sorry. This should be little m, where m is the mass of the projectile, and there's a little m on this side. So you can cancel out little m. And this is the formula for the escape velocity. And they just plugged in. They said, supposing the escape velocity is the speed of light, c squared equals 2mg over r. And from that, they made the difficult calculation of computing how small the star would have to be in order that this was satisfied. And the answer was, of course, r sub s. S, you all know, stands for Schwarzschild, but Schwarzschild was still unborn for another couple of hundred years. R Schwarzschild is equal to 2mg over c squared.
And then, why were they interested in c squared? What was special to them about c?
It was the speed of light. No, they were asking a question. They were asking a very practical question. Could there be stars out there that astronomers couldn't see?
Yeah, but why did they focus on the speed of light?
Because they were interested in...
It was 1800 or so, right?
This was a little before 1800,
yeah.
1780.
So why, what was in their minds about
that telescopes see light? They were interested in looking out in the sky with telescopes and wondering, could there be stars that were just invisible to them? Now, no, you're asking an interesting question. The interesting question was this. They had no idea at the time that the speed of light was an ultimate barrier to speed. So they were not asking the question the way we would ask it today, is it possible that there are things that are really just permanently out of our ken, that we're in a ken that we cannot ever see by any means? They were astronomers. Okay? Every physicist at that time was an astronomer, and they were interested in whether there might be stars. They just couldn't be seen by telescopes. Okay. So this was it. You see, this was it. If the star was smaller than R Schwarzschild for a given mass, then it couldn't be seen. Okay, let's just plug in some numbers to get some sense of the order of magnitude. In fact, most of this lecture, I'm going to set the speed of light equal to 1. But for the moment, let's keep it around. Okay, for the sun, if we take the mass of the sun, then R Schwarzschild corresponds to about 3 kilometers. So if you could squeeze the sun down to 3 kilometers, it would become what they call the dark star. Incidentally, the sun will never become a black hole. It'll get stuck at the white dwarf stage. But if the star was about 5 times heavier than the sun, it would eventually collapse and get within its own Schwarzschild radius. All right, let's go a little further with basic Newtonian theory. Just consider a couple of other questions. Tidal forces. We all have the habit of saying you could fall freely through the horizon of a black hole, a solar mass black hole, for example. Could you really? No, not really. You'd get squished like toothpaste coming out of a toothpaste container if you tried to fall, maybe worse than that, a lot worse than that, in fact. So let's calculate the tidal forces just to get some idea of what it would be like to fall into a dark star. We're assuming now that the radius is smaller than the Schwarzschild radius. And in fact, let's assume it's very, very small. The Schwarzschild radius is then just a mathematical surface. And let's ask what it would be like to fall through such a surface. So here's the surface in question at R Schwarzschild. Here's somebody falling through. And what is their experience? Well, their experience, of course, is that they feel tidal forces. Tidal forces simply mean a gradient of the gravitational force. The gravitational force pulls harder on your feet than on your head, and so you get stretched. Okay, you get stretched according to the title force. Let's get some estimate of what it would be like to fall through a solar mass black hole. Okay, so the acceleration due to gravity is gm over r squared. Right. We're interested in the gradient capital A now stands for acceleration. The gradient of the acceleration, the A by the R, goes like gm over R cubed. I'm not interested in numerical factor here. Right. And now let's plug in what the gradient of the acceleration would be like at the Schwarzschild radius. So let's put in here R Schwarzschild cubed, but let me put it in the form R Schwarzschild, 1 over R Schwarzschild squared. Now, gm over R Schwarzschild, that's C squared. A big number divided by R Schwarzschild squared. The point is that we often forget in thinking about these things that the speed of light for our own practical purposes is not small, it's enormously big. And so the gradient of the, in ordinary human units, the gradient of the acceleration is enormously big because of the speed of light squared. Let's take the 3 kilometer radius of the sun. Let's take 10 kilometers. I'm not good at multiplying and dividing by 3, so let's take 10 kilometers. That would be about the size of a star which collapsed. 10 kilometer Schwarzschild radius. Then, let's see, 10 kilometers means 10 to the 4th meters, so this would be 10 to the 8th downstairs, but C squared is about 10 to the 17th in metric system, ordinary metric system, and so this is something like 10 to the 9th. A billion, the acceleration, the gradient of the acceleration would be about a billion, whatever the units of acceleration are. And you would not fare very well at the horizon of a black hole. This is not specifically something to do with the horizon itself. It's not that you get killed at the horizon. You get killed long before that. If you ask how far do you have to go out before the gradient of the acceleration would stretch you like spaghetti, it's pretty far out of orbit of the moon, maybe further than that. I don't remember the number. This is not specific to the to the horizon itself. Okay. But notice the tidal forces go like 1 over r squared, 1 over r Schwarzschild squared. C squared is just there. I put that in just to give you a feel for the numbers in human terms. Okay. Well, incidentally, how big would a black hole have to be in order that you would survive passage of the horizon? The bigger the black hole is, the better off you are. And if the black hole, I think I estimated that if it was about 10 to the 5th kilometers, which corresponds to a mass of about 10 to the 5th solar masses, you'd be fine passing through the horizon. However, you would last about a second before you hit the singularity. So passing into black holes, astronomical black holes, is not a comfortable thing to do. The biggest black holes that we know about in nature are something like about a billion solar masses. In that case, you would freely, easily fall through the horizon with no tidal disruption, and you'd last about 20 minutes before you hit the singularity. On the other hand, there's nothing in principle that doesn't allow much, much bigger black holes. So you could imagine a black hole big enough that you could pass through the horizon without even noticing it and last for a billion years before hitting the singularity. And I want you to think now and then about such black holes, because the deepest paradoxes come when you think about the biggest black holes, when you think about the possibility that black holes could be so big that you really could pass freely through them, last for a billion years, and nothing much happens to you. Okay, that's basic Laplace Mitchell theory. I want, before actually starting on the subject proper of general relativity and black holes, I want to give you one more little toy example of how black holes work. It's due to Bill Unruh. I believe it's due to Bill Unruh. I'm not sure who the first person to think about it was. It's what Bill Unruh calls dumb holes. Not dumb because they're stupid, dumb because they're silent. Silent in the same whole sense that black holes are dark. So it's an analogy in which sound replaces light, and here's my version of it. Imagine an infinite lake of a depth of a meter or two. So here's the surface of an infinite lake. At the center of the lake, of course, infinite lakes, every place is the center, but let's pick a center. At the center of the lake, there's a drain hole. And the drain hole empties out down below onto some very sharp rocks. Okay. Now, the gravity is strong enough that it pulls the water through very rapidly, so rapidly that at some distance, in fact, first of all, if you go very far away and you look at the velocity of the water will be very small, so you'll see an inward flow toward the drain. But the inward flow will be very negligibly small, the velocity of it. As you approach the drain hole, as you might expect, the velocity picks up. And eventually, at some point, if the flow is strong enough, either you can imagine gravity is strong enough to pull it, not the model gravity, but just, you know, real gravity in the surface of this lake here, is strong enough that at some point it allows the flow to exceed the speed of sound. Okay? Now, there are creatures who live in this lake, and these creatures have a law. Oh, there they are. They're polywogs. These creatures have a law, and the law is they're not allowed to exceed the speed of sound relative to the flow of water. Now, what is life like for them? They can't see. All they can do is transmit sound waves back and forth. The sound waves behave like light waves as far as they're concerned, and they can communicate, they can all do all the things that that we would expect them to be able to do, but it's a dangerous drain. The reason it's dangerous is not because when you get to the point where the speed of sound is achieved, there's nothing particularly dangerous there. A polywog floating through would pass through that point just totally relaxed and not realize anything was happening. But once a point passes that point, he's doomed. Doomed because he can neither swim faster than the speed of sound. That's a rule. That's a law. Can't swim faster than the speed of sound. And can't even send a message faster than the speed of sound. So once he's trapped within that place, and I call that place the point of no return. The point of no return, the PNR, the point of no return is a point from which, if a polywog did get, does everybody know what a polywog is? That's a technical term. Okay, good. Everybody knows what a polywog is. If you don't like polywogs, think of fish. If the polywog passes the point of no return, is truly doomed. Inside that region, the flow is faster than the speed of sound. He can neither outswim it, nor even send a message out. And ultimately is going to be crushed on the rocks below. Somebody outside, of course, has no particular problem unless they allow themselves to pass the point of no return. And so the point of no return is, of course, the analog of the horizon of a black hole. This is a better picture in some respects than the Laplace picture of the black hole for the following reason. The Laplace picture of the black hole said that you can't send a signal to infinity from the Schwarzschild radius. It didn't say you couldn't send a signal out a little bit. It said that light will return before escaping to infinity, but it did not say that light could not get 100 meters from the surface. In that respect, the dumb hole here is a better model of the black hole, because sound, in this case, can not only not escape to infinity from within the point of no return, it can't even get to the point of no return. So you can't send a message out altogether from the point of no return. There are some interesting facts about this. If we imagined a observer out here, who I usually call Bob, and Bob sent Alice into the black hole. Bob could send Alice into the black hole. Alice could try to communicate with Bob. Alice is a singer, but all she can do is achieve middle C. That's the only note that she can achieve. That's what's like 262 cycles per second. Anybody remember middle C? I think it is. 262 hertz. Mm-hmm. Now, as she approaches the black hole, of course, the Doppler shift lowers her tone relative to Bob. And as she gets near the point of no return, where the velocity tends to the speed of sound, the tone of her voice will go down from middle C to B to A. And as she gets closer and closer, the sound waves will be drawn out into lower and lower and lower frequencies. So you will see the effect at the black hole of redshift of signals which are emitted near the horizon. At the horizon itself, it will take an infinite, I call it the horizon, the point of no return. At the point of no return, it will take simply an infinite amount of time for a signal to get out. It's because the flow inward would balance exactly the speed going out. And so you would get no signal from anywhere inside the horizon. From slightly outside the horizon, it would take a very, very long, long time to get a signal. And so you would have this strange situation, this strange dichotomy, that Alice, floating freely through the horizon, would discover nothing unusual at the horizon. And according to her own clock, her own wristwatch, her own metabolism, it would take a perfectly finite time for her to pass the horizon. On the other hand, Bob, watching her from a distance, would see her slow down, slow down, slow down, would see her voice get deeper and deeper and deeper, and he would notice that it would take an infinite amount of time for her to cross the horizon, at least according to his own perceptions. You say, big deal, we understand this. This is a very clear thing, there's nothing very special about it. But it does represent two different points of view. All the experiments that Bob would ever do on Alice as she falls through, or on the vicinity of the horizon and so forth, would be consistent with the statement that he sees her take an infinite time to fall through, while she herself gets to fall through in a finite amount of time. So this is a kind of tension between the two observations from outside, let's call it from sometimes people who are stationed outside black holes are called fiducial observers, F-I-D-O's. That's a term I think that's due to Kip Thorne. And the other kind, those fiducial observers are ones who are stationed outside. They can be stationed anywhere. And in contrast to them, there are freely falling observers who can freely fall through the horizon. My term for them is freefos. And so we see a kind of tension in the perceptions of FIDOs and FREFOs. If we were to ask them what happened, according to their own perceptions of sound, we'd get very different answers. The FIDOs would say it took an infinite amount of time for the FREFO to fall through the horizon. The FREFO would say, nonsense, it took me a finite amount of time. But they could not communicate to each other, at least after she has fallen through the horizon. So there would be no obvious observational inconsistency. They simply couldn't communicate their what looks like inconsistent perceptions. Now again, in this picture here, you can see that there would be tidal forces. The velocities have a gradient. If you took a nice soft blob of some kind, a bit of oil, for example, on the water, and think of yourself as a very, very, so no matter how much you work out in the gym, compared to the Planck scale, you are a very soft blob. Okay, so a very, very small, a very, very soft blob of some sort of material falls in, what happens is easy to imagine. If the blob has any appreciable size, it will get pulled in like toothpaste and be very badly disrupted. But again, this has nothing specific to do with the horizon. And if you took a small enough object, a sufficiently small object, such that the gradient across it of the flow, or in the case of black hole, the gradient of gravity across it was small, then it would freely fall through the horizon and nothing much happened to it. Okay, so again, Doppler shift is important here in the perceptions, and this again is a model of a black hole. Now, it fails at some level, of course. I don't need to tell you in what way it fails. One way that it fails is that things could just keep falling into the dumb hole without affecting the dumb hole. You could keep dropping things in and dropping things in and dropping things in, and it would have no effect on the size of the dumb hole and so forth, which of course is not correct for a real black hole. But in other respects, it really does capture a good deal of the ideas of black holes. Okay, now let's come to the real thing. Let's come to Schwarzschild black holes. And in this class, I am only going to, well, I might get a little bit to charged black holes, because I will be interested in the electrodynamics of black holes a little bit. But let's, for the most part, concentrate on the simplest black holes. The simplest black holes are Schwarzschild black holes. The object is to try to get them right. The getting them right means getting their quantum mechanics right, getting their Hawking radiation right, getting their Bekenstein entropy right, and above all, trying to understand in what sense information is or isn't conserved when a black hole evaporates. And for these purposes, a Schwarzschild black hole is, to my mind, an ideal setup to ask the question. It's a hard situation to answer the question, but it is an easy situation to ask the question. And the Schwarzschild black hole is so generic, the properties of its horizon are so generic and so general, that it would be very good to be able to answer the questions there. Okay, let's write down the Schwarzschild metric. I'll remind you what it looks like.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah.
The fact that the Schwarzschild black hole compared to 181 has a negative specific heat, does it affect at some point some of the reasoning you're going to do?
So, of course it does. Of course it does. It means it's not really a stable object. So physicists are forever trying to put black holes into boxes to stabilize them. The problem with boxes is that if you put a black hole into a box, you know, there's jitteriness in nature. The jitteriness comes from thermal, it comes from quantum mechanics, and so the black hole jitters around, things bounce off the box and the box jitters around. If you wait long enough, an accident will happen and the edge of the box will touch the horizon of the black hole. What will happen then? The box will get pulled right into the black hole. So the idea of eternal black holes in physical boxes is really itself not much better than the black hole that can evaporate. The answer to this is anti-de Sitter space. Anti-de Sitter space is a box in which you can put a black hole in which the edges of the box simply cannot get sucked into the black hole. So we'll come to that. But yes, I mean, the answer is the fact that the black hole has a negative specific heat means it's unstable. But so is the sun, incidentally. The sun also has a negative, I assume you know that, but the sun has a negative specific heat. As it radiates, it gets hotter. It's no worse than that. It's no worse than that. The sun seems to be pretty damn stable. It's lasting a long time. Of course, it radiates. And as it radiates, it shrinks. As it shrinks, it grows hotter. And the same thing is true of a black hole. Anything involving gravity, that's true. Incidentally, it's even true of an atom. As an atom radiates down, the electron speeds up. If you count the temperature as being related to the velocity of the electron, then the specific heat of an atom is also negative. So it's not that unusual a thing. It does mean that the thermodynamics is not really rigorously given by a partition function and so forth, but you know, we'll come to those things. Okay, let's write down the Schwarzschild metric. I am now going to set the speed of light to 1. I'm going to work with proper time having a time-like signature. And so that's 1 minus 2mg over r times dt squared minus 1 minus 2mg over r inverse dr squared minus r squared d omega squared. All right, omega is the unit 2 sphere. The coordinate r is defined in such a way that the area of a sphere at a given distance, r is not strictly in any sense the proper distance from the center. That doesn't even mean anything. What it is it's such that the area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared. That's its definition. And that's the only definition of r that we'll use. Well, we'll use other definitions of coordinates, but r will mean the thing which determines the area of a sphere at a given distance from the black hole. All right, with that r, this is the metric. This factor is inverse to this factor. If I were to restore the speeds of light, I think there would be c squared downstairs, but I'm not interested in doing so. The horizon. And we'll see why this is true, is at r equals 2mg, same place that Laplace and Mitchell would have put equals r Schwarzschild, same r Schwarzschild. The singularity is at r equals 0. Here's the black hole. And the first thing that I would want to calculate if I were going to do a bunch of calculations on the blackboard is I would like to ask, if you start an object, a point particle, or a person or anything else, at a distance r from the black hole, capital R from the black hole, I'm going to don't mind whether I use small r or big R. They're interchangeable. How long would it take to pass the horizon? Now, you can ask that from two points of view. You can ask it from the Fido point of view, or you can ask it from the free-fall point of view. From the free-fall point of view, we're asking along this person's trajectory, as they fall in, what's the proper time that it takes, the time on that person's wristwatch, in order to cross the horizon. Now remember, they won't see anything spectacular happen at the horizon, but they might have measured the mass of the black hole, they might know, because they're theoretical physicists, where the horizon is, and so they can ask, how long will it take before I reach the point, the mathematical point where the horizon is? And I'm just going to write down the answer for you. What you have to do is very simple. You simply have to calculate the geodesic motion of a falling object. It's very simple, not hard to calculate in this metric, and then integrate up the proper time until you get to the horizon. I'll write down the answer for you. Let's see, I have it here. Where did it go? Here it is. The proper time tau to get to the horizon from a point r, and when I say from a point r, I mean from a point r at rest. A point r at rest is equal to r Schwarzschild times pi over 2 times r over r Schwarzschild to the 3/2 power. Now, the only thing of interest about this is, first of all, it scales like R Schwarzschild. It contains the ratio of R to R Schwarzschild to the 3/2 power, not so interesting. The pi over 2 is not interesting at all, but Mostly, this is finite. This is a finite number which you could estimate, and if you fall from a distance comparable to the Schwarzschild radius, you'll cross the horizon in the time proportional to the Schwarzschild radius. Okay. At the same time, and this will not become clear perhaps until a little later in the lecture, a Fido watching this from a distance would see this infalling observer take an infinite time to cross the horizon. And so again, this same tension between the observations of Fido's and Fido's.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So if you're starting at this watch radius, you're already at
the point. No. Starting at R.
Right, but you just said if you put RS there, it's not zero.
Let's see what happens. That's peculiar, isn't it? Maybe this might have been a distance to the singularity. It's possible this was a distance to the singularity. I suspect it is. Yeah. It's comparable, though, it's probably the distance to the singularity. My mistake. Good point. Okay. So that's how long you get to last before you're destroyed. Let's just draw a picture of what a Schwarzschild black hole looks like. This is a naive picture, not in any special coordinates or actually in Schwarzschild coordinates. These are Schwarzschild coordinates. All right, the black hole looks like a cylinder. The interior of the cylinder is the interior of the black hole, R less than R Schwarzschild. Right. If a observer falls in, his trajectory from the outside looks about like this. But when I say from the outside, this is what their trajectory looks like. And in fact, as we will see, in Schwarzschild time means the time that goes into the Schwarzschild formula, it would take an infinite amount of time to cross the horizon. Okay, so that's one fact. That's an infalling observer. If there was an observer, a Fido, far away, and the infalling observer sent signals out, signals, light signals, for example, the light signals would look something like this. They would get more and more drawn out. This distance should get bigger and bigger. And so the distant observer watching will see everything slow down and will see it take an infinite amount of time for the infalling observer to fall through the horizon. A light ray emitted very, very near the horizon will stay very... maybe we should work that out. What about light rays? How do light rays behave? Light rays correspond to d tau equals zero. Okay. So our d tau is 1 minus 2mg over r, dr squared, dt squared, minus the same thing, inverse, dr squared. Set that equal to 0 for a light ray, and we find that dr by dt for a light ray is equal, I think, to just 1 minus 2mg. Let's write it as r minus 2mg over r. All right? So the important thing is that dr dt goes to zero at the horizon, which means, effectively, at the horizon, a light ray will stand still, in exactly the same sense that a sound wave would stand still at the point of no return. So a light ray emitted just outside the horizon will hug the horizon for a long time, very, very small dr dt, and then eventually depart. And eventually, when it gets very far, R over R goes to 1, and the light ray will move like a light ray is supposed to move, with a velocity, a coordinate velocity equal to 1. All right, that's the basic setup for Schwarzschild black hole. Now I want to introduce some specialized coordinates. These specialized coordinates have different purposes. The first specialized coordinates I want to call tortoise coordinates. Tortoise coordinates are very good for solving the wave equation. And we will have a great deal to do with solving the wave equation in the black hole background. This will be an important thing to be able to do. Tortoise coordinates are the nice coordinates for that. Now, tortoise coordinates have simple properties when you think about R and T. When you think about the angular degrees of freedom, they're a little more complicated, not much. But with respect to R and T, they're called conformally flat. So let me explain what conformal flatness means. Most of you know what conformal flatness is, but let's spell it out. Conformal flatness, of course, is a property of a geometry. Okay? But we can also speak about, in conformally flat geometries, we can speak about conformally flat coordinates. So I'm interested in the RT plane. All two-dimensional geometries are conformally flat. And so there always exist coordinates in two dimensions which have the property of conformal flatness. And conformal flatness means, let's start with flat space, two-dimensional flat space, RT, just the RT plane. That, of course, would have a metric dt squared minus dr squared. Right. Light rays would correspond to dt equals dr, or dt equals minus dr, and they would correspond to 45-degree motions in the RT plane, radio light waves. Conformal flatness means that the coordinates are of this form times some function of r and t. In our particular case, it's only going to be a function of r. In that case, light rays are still 45 degrees. This f doesn't make any difference. dt equals dr will still define light rays. So conformal coordinates are coordinates in which light rays travel at 45 degrees. Radio light waves. I'm only interested in the radial part of things now. All right, it's not hard. Let's figure out how to do this. F, let's call F by definition 1 minus 2mg over R. And our metric has the form F of R dt squared minus 1 over F of R dr squared. And I want to write that as F of R times dt squared minus du squared. Or let's see, I guess it's dr star squared. That's just the radial time part of the metric. Let's look for an r star which satisfies that. Well, it's very easy. All you do is put a bracket around this. Well, I didn't quite get it right. I pulled out an f of r, so there's got to be an f of r squared here. And if I set the r over f of r equal to dr star, that solves the problem of putting the metric into conformally flat form. Dr over f of r, which is 1 minus 2mg over r, is equal to dr star. Easy integral to do, and I'll tell you what the answer is. R star, the so-called tortoise coordinate, I'll tell you in a minute why it's called the tortoise coordinate. You might have called it the snail coordinate. R star is equal to R plus 2mg log of R minus 2mg divided by 2mg. Now, I don't know why in my lecture notes I didn't call 2mg R Schwarzschild. It would have saved me a lot of writing, but I didn't. So you can in your notes. 2mg is R Schwarzschild. Let's see what it looks like. For large r, the logarithm is not a very interesting thing for large r. For large r, r and r star, or the ratio of r to r star, goes to 1. So for large r, r and r star are essentially the same thing. But when you get near the horizon, r equals minus 2mg, this thing blows up and goes to minus infinity. So r star goes to minus infinity at the horizon. The tortoise coordinate only covers the outside of the black hole. It doesn't cover the inside. R star runs from infinity far away to minus infinity at the horizon. The reason it's called a tortoise coordinate is because you are supposed to imagine that the tortoise just takes an infinite amount of time to make it to the horizon.
I thought it was Achilles who couldn't catch up with the tortoise. He had a race with the tortoise.
Yeah, and Zeno was watching the whole thing. And,
each time he had the distance that was.
The only answer that I can give you is I'm not responsible for the terminology. I just suppose, yeah. Good. Just remember, I've got this. Robert is one of my oldest friends. I don't know anybody older than him. Actually, it is true. Robert is one of my oldest friends. In many ways. Boy, did I see you do the jitterbug and on 6th Street once.
So long I can't, yeah.
I said, I remember watching you do the jitterbug with... right, when Francois and I got kicked out the bar for dancing with each other.
Elaborate.
Yeah. Yeah, Robert, Francois, and I, Francois and Blair, went to some bar in 6th Street in Austin, and they were playing some, dirty, low-down jazz, and, it was New Orleans, jazz.
It was funky.
It was very funky. And Robert found some young girl to jitterbug with. And Francois and I couldn't get any girl to dance with us, so we started dancing together. We started doing the jitterbug. And some big guy came over to us. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say this to this audience. Okay. If you faggots don't get out of here, I'm going to break both your legs. You remember that? Long time ago. Okay, so black holes. Where are we? Yeah. All right. So let's just write the metric then in these tortoise coordinates. Let's write it carefully. There's R star. There's also R. R is a function of R star. Here it is. I would hate to try to invert that, and I won't. But d tau squared is equal to 1 minus 2 mg over r, where r is a function of r star, times dt squared minus dr star squared, and then, of course, plus good old, minus good old r squared, where r squared, again, is a function of r star, the omega squared. All right. Now, what is especially interesting about these coordinates is that when we go to write the wave equation, we're going to find that the tr part of it looks exactly like a free wave equation in two-dimensional flat space. If you know it, good, otherwise I'll derive it. In two dimensions, if you have a conformally flat metric and you write the wave equation, the factor that appears in front of it doesn't enter the wave equation. So the wave equation will have a very simple form. And the angular dependence here, that will simply be taken into account by working with spherical harmonics. We're working with spherical harmonics. And you'll have a relatively simple wave equation. So put this aside for now. The point of this was to get you set up to study wave equations. Let's see, my notes here are, my notes are slightly out of order. Let's go next to near horizon coordinates. Near horizon coordinates are very, very useful in understanding the properties of the horizon. And when I speak of near horizon coordinates, I'm not only going to speak of coordinates near the horizon, but near a point on the horizon. I'm going to concentrate on a point on the horizon and set up a coordinate system near the horizon there that describes the properties of a localized point near a horizon. Now, the horizon I want you to imagine is very big. So when I say a localized point near the horizon, I may mean a very, very big region. In other words, the tangent plane to the sphere here, or this question? The sphere will be treated in the tangent plane approximation, and as far as radial distances, will never go very far from the horizon. Now, very far can mean a zillion miles if the black hole is big enough. All right, let's do that exercise. This is going to teach us what the horizon is really like. First, let's consider proper distance from the horizon. Proper spatial distance from the horizon. I'll call that rho. This is proper spatial distance from the horizon. We don't need point coordinates anymore. That's given by the integral from the horizon to mg out to distance r of the square root of grr. Okay. Standard definition of proper distance. And if you plug in what the square root of grr is, do the integral. The integral is a little bit of a nuisance, but if you concentrate on the region near the horizon, it's very easy to do. And you find that rho is just given by 2. This is near horizon, so we should put some wiggle there. 2 square root of 2mg times r minus 2mg. Okay, so apart from some the usual normalization constants that go into these things, rho is simply the square root of the coordinate distance, the Schwarzschild coordinate distance from the horizon. You can solve this for r minus 2mg. You're obviously going to get something involving rho squared. So it's pretty clear that the metric near the horizon is going to involve rho squared. All right, so if you solve for r minus 2mg, plug back into the horizon, plug back into the metric, here's what you get. You get the tau squared equals rho squared, as I said, that's just the r minus 2mg over 2mg, dt squared dt over 4mg squared minus d rho squared. Why d rho squared? Because rho is the proper distance from the horizon. So it's automatic that this is just d rho squared, and this is all you get near the horizon. And notice that the metric, the time component of the metric goes to zero at the horizon, just the way it should, same as the Schwarzschild metric does. So this does have the property of slowing down time at the horizon. And then, of course, plus, let's first write it, r squared, the omega squared. But since we're near the horizon, r is just r Schwarzschild squared. So this can just be taken to be r Schwarzschild squared. But I'm going to do something else. I'm going to take the region near the horizon, take the tangent plane, and just describe the tangent plane by x and y. This is just dx squared plus dy squared. Okay, we can always normalize x and y so that r squared d omega squared, the metric on a sphere, near a point, the tangent approximation, is minus dx squared plus dy squared. This looks pretty simple, and it is pretty simple. This is a disguised form of flat space. So let's see why this is just plain old flat space. First of all, define t divided by 4mg to be something. Let's call it omega. T over 4mg. It's entirely obvious by now that I've made a big mistake in not normalizing everything to the Schwarzschild radius. But I really did want to keep explicit things like the Schwarzschild radius, at least for the moment. I didn't want to get the discussion too abstract. I wanted to keep it really concrete. I forget where the speed of light goes. It goes in there somewhere. Okay, let's call that omega. Okay, so omega is a new time variable which is just normalized, not to the Schwarzschild radius, but to twice the Schwarzschild radius, turns out. Then we can write this metric. We can write this metric in the simplified form, the omega squared. Now, if this were Euclidean space, let's imagine this were Euclidean space instead of Minkowski space. To make it Euclidean space, I will use the yellow chalk to put a plus sign here. That would turn it into Euclidean space. By Euclidean space, I now mean Euclidean signature. We would immediately recognize rho squared d omega squared plus d rho squared as polar coordinates, flat space and polar coordinates. Omega would be angle, rho squared, rho would be radius. Omega would be angle, this would be r squared, d theta squared, this would be r squared, and this would just be the metric of a simple plane. Okay, a simple Euclidean plane. And this would just be dx squared plus with dy squared. So what this would be then would be just plain flat space in cylindrical polar coordinates. Okay. With the minus sign here, it's flat space-time in cylindrical hyperbolic polar coordinates. One of the lessons, we'll be a little more specific in a moment, but the lesson is that the horizon is not an unusual place. Locally, a point near the horizon is just flat space. Flat space, a little bit of a deviation from flat space, a little bit of curvature, the curvature being like the curvature of a sphere when you're approximating it by the tangent approximation. All right, if we want to get to a flat space metric, we simply introduce Cartesian coordinates, conventional Cartesian coordinates. Here we are. Not r cosine theta and r sine theta, but we can define z to be rho cosh omega, t to be rho sinh omega. And then if we rewrite this metric, it's just t squared minus dz squared minus dx squared, minus dy squared. In other words, it's flat space and flat space time with a light cone, conventional light cone, in a kind of spherical polar coordinates. The radial coordinate, let's look at what, remember what rho is. Rho is proper distance from the horizon. It's a function of r. It's a function of Schwarzschild r. All the various radial coordinates so far are functions of each other. So looking at rho equals a constant is the same as looking at r equals a constant and so forth. R equals a constant or rho equals a constant is hyperboloids. Hyperboloids, which look like this. Rho equals zero, that's the horizon. That's where the coefficient of the metric goes to zero. So the horizon, r equals 2mg, is right over there. And now if we look at lines of constant omega, incidentally, as formulated, the metric really only covers the outside of the black hole, which is this region here. But of course, there's no reason not to extrapolate it into the interior. We'll see what that means as we go along. But lines of constant omega, which means lines of constant time. Remember what omega is. Omega is t divided by 4mg. So lines of constant omega are lines of constant angle on here. And they accumulate as you go to the light cone. Each interval of omega corresponds to a smaller and smaller angle until you get to omega equals infinity, And omega equals infinity, that's the light cone over here. Omega equals infinity. This light cone, together with this light cone, have two significances. One is that they are t equals minus infinity and t equals plus infinity. On the one hand, okay, Schwarzschild time. Schwarzschild time t equals minus infinity, Schwarzschild time t equals plus infinity. On the other hand, a hyperbola extremely close to these lines corresponds to a very, very small proper distance from the horizon. In other words, it corresponds to r equals 2mg plus a tiny little bit. So roughly speaking, the whole hyperboloid here, sorry, the whole light cone here, the two branches of it, are the horizon, r equals 2mg, but they correspond to the horizon at infinitely late time and horizon at infinitely early time. So this is the geometry of the near-horizon Schwarzschild black hole. So black holes are really simple. There's nothing going on at the horizon. It's just flat space. Oh, we can also see something else now. We can also see that if there's an informing observer, here's an informing observer, falls through the horizon. I'll tell you in a little while why really this line is the horizon. But you can see one thing, that from the point of view of the Schwarzschild coordinate time, that observer doesn't cross the horizon until t equals infinity. You can see that from this diagram here. On the other hand, there's absolutely nothing infinite about the proper time that it takes to get to that horizon over here. So we see just graphically why there is this discrepancy, t equals infinity from the outside, finite amount of proper time to fall through the horizon. Any questions? Yeah?
What do you mean when you say a horizon at infinitely early time?
Okay, so let's, yeah, good. Let's take this plot and compare it with Schwarzschild coordinates, right? Schwarzschild coordinates outside the horizon. So this could be r equals 2mg. All right, here's t equals 0. Here's t equals 1. Here's t equals 2, and so forth. T equals minus 1, and so forth. All right, what do these lines look like when plotted on here? All right, let's do a little more. Here's the different, here's r, here's lines of constant r. Lines of constant r are vertical, lines of constant time are horizontal. Remember, there's something peculiar about this point, namely that the metric goes to zero over here. So the proper time between any point over here and over here is zero. That's why it's all mapped to a single point over here. All right, the horizontal lines just map to the radial lines like so. So this is just a mapping. It's just a mapping of the Schwarzschild coordinates onto a geometry which more faithfully shows that there's no proper time between points on the horizon. They all sort of squeeze together. The hyperboloids here are lines of constant r, and the angular lines here are lines of constant time. If we go way back into the remote past, then we're talking about a radial line which is practically way, way back here. Okay. On the other hand, we can then pass to the horizon at very, very early times. And that, you might think, is just passing to this point. And it is. It's passing to this point. But remember that along a light cone, the proper distance along the light cone is zero. So for a hyperboloid extremely close to the light cone here, it corresponds to a point very, very close to the horizon. So going way, way down into the deep past means going to t equals minus infinity here, and going to the horizon means going to a hyperboloid which is very, very close to passing through this point. Okay, so that's what I mean. The question? No. Okay. All right. All of this is fairly elementary.
Let's see, what time did I start? I started at 10:30, so what am I supposed to, how long am I supposed to go?
Okay. All right, that'll allow us to get the Kruskal coordinates. Kruskal-Zekeres coordinates. Kruskal-Zekeres coordinates are good for showing the geometry, the RT geometry of the global structure of the black hole. Can't do it. What do I do? Which one was I pulling? Wait a minute, there was something I couldn't read. Let's come to Kruskal coordinates. This is another specialized set of coordinates, but their value is they show the whole global structure of the black hole on one diagram. Again, the purpose, well, let's see. I lost my page with Kruskal coordinates. It's terrible. Okay, let's work it out then. Kruskal coordinates work as follows. We at one point had an expression which looked like rho d omega squared. Rho squared d omega squared minus d rho squared. That was the near horizon geometry in a sort of polar coordinate representation. All right, we're going to generalize this. This is just purely the near horizon part of the geometry. There's also plus the angular part here, which I'm going to leave out. We're going to call rho R, first of all, capital R. Now, this doesn't stand for any of the R's that we've used so far. It stands for Kruskal R. But this is going to get multiplied by a function of R. Now, near the horizon, we've already seen that it's just rho squared d omega squared minus d rho squared. That suggests that f of r should go to 1 at the horizon, and rho and r would be the same thing near the horizon. That's correct. Okay? But let's see how we can put the entire metric in precisely this form. Remember what the omega squared is. It's dt squared over 4mg squared. And now let's compare this form of the metric with the Schwarzschild form of the metric. That will give us some equations for f of r. First of all, we'll find that f of r times r squared, that's the coefficient of the omega squared. We should probably divide this now by 4mg squared, 4mg squared. This will be the coefficient of dt squared. If we compare that with the Schwarzschild form of the metric, we have one equation for f of r, which is just that this is equal to 1 minus 2mg over r. I think I have that right. This is the coefficient of dt squared, and that's also the coefficient of dt squared. On the other hand, f of r, the r squared, must also be equal to f of r, the r squared, must equal 1 divided by 1 minus 2mg over r, the r squared. Okay. How do we solve these two equations? Let's multiply this by 4mg squared. Let's divide by r squared. And now we have a formula for f of r. If we stick this formula of f of r into the bottom equation, we'll get a simple integral to do. Yeah, take the top equation, f of r equals 1 minus 2mg, blah, 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 and stick it into the bottom equation, so we get 1 minus 2mg over r times 4mg over r squared. That's f of r, the r squared equals 1 over 1 minus 2mg over r, the r squared. And now we can separate it. We can get everything involving capital R on one side, everything involving small r on the other side, and then we just have an integral to do, and we can calculate capital R in terms of small r. I'll give you the answer. Capital R is equal to mg logarithm of 2 There's something wrong with my notes. There's something wrong with my notes. There is an integral to do. I don't seem to have the integral in front of me here. Is it the same as R star? I seem to have lost my expression for capital R. I don't know what I did with it. Does anybody know what it is?
It looks like log capital R is R star.
Log capital R is R star. That's right. That's right. That's right. Log capital R. Yeah. That's right. Log capital R. That's exactly right. Log capital R equals R star. Well, R star was the tortoise coordinate. Yeah. R star is equal to e to the r.
Yeah, you see that from the differential.
Yeah. That's right. All right, so the main point is that there is a coordinate capital R. It goes to zero at the horizon, I believe. You see, R star goes to minus infinity. So capital R goes to zero at the horizon. And if we plot what the black hole looks like in these Kruskal coordinates. The Kruskal coordinates are capital R and omega. Same omega. Omega is t over 4mg. Same exact omega. Then here's what the black hole looked like. Remember what it looked like in the near horizon limit. In the near horizon limit, it just looked like flat space. Okay. It still looks pretty much like flat space. Capital R is a radial distance. Near the horizon, it looks like just proper distance. But as you go further and further out from the horizon, capital R begins to look like small r. Capital R tends to small r very, very far away. This is the Schwarzschild coordinate. The Schwarzschild coordinate, very, very far away, is just good old R, flat space R. Why is that? Because the metric associated with BR just goes to 1 at large distances. So very, very far away,
capital R is just what you would ordinarily call R, far from the black hole. Near the horizon, it goes to proper distance. So it goes to proper.
For dimensions, one of these has to be non-dimensional.
Yes, yes. So there's probably always four energies.
It's R star over RS?
Yeah. It must be.
And the capital R is dimensional.
I don't remember.
But one of them has to be dimensional.
Yeah, one of them has to be dimensional, absolutely. Okay, so let's see. I do have it here, I think. And I think it's probably R star, I think, was that inch. I can't remember. Okay. I'll get it. For some reason, I seem to have lost a page. What's that?
R, big R.
Big R is equal to the. Yeah, both of these can't be true, can they?
Look of R is. Now this one is okay. The other one is.
Which one is right? This one's right?
Wrong.
This one's wrong, okay. But there is a correct relationship that looks something like that. Let's see. That it must be R equals E to the R star.
It's a different equation.
Yeah, it is the same equation.
This one is okay.
It's log big R over 4.
You define R star. At far distances, which is equal to R.
That's
so
right.
So R is a distance.
So R is a distance. So this must be over 4 mg. This must be over 4 mg.
And the log by distance.
And
multiply the log by distance.
Yeah. Probably 4 mg. I think that's right. Yeah. For some reason, I just lost a page in my notes. But the question is, what does the geometry look like? Okay. One interesting question is how it's quite apparent all of these coordinates cover this region here. But there's no reason why you can't continue them into the rest of the space. This is not a natural boundary of the space-time. It's natural just to continue it. A particle can fall through there. It's natural to continue the metric through there. If you continue the metric through there, and remember now that capital R is a function of small r, and small r equals 0 is the place where the singularity is. You can ask where the singularity is in these coordinates. Well, you start following in, and you get to r equals 2mg. You can't go any further. But if you analytically continue the coordinates, you discover that little r can be continued into this region, where it continues vertically upward. What happens is it becomes imaginary. Big R becomes imaginary in this region here. Little r just continues and goes vertically upward. T equals 0. Schwarzschild time t equals 0 looks like that, but when you get behind the horizon, because 1 minus 2mg over r changes sign, the space-like and time-like character of r and t change. So when you go behind the horizon, which is this region here, your time coordinate, t equals 0, makes a right angle turn like that. Let's find t equals 1. T equals 1 would look like this, and then it would make a right angle turn like that. That doesn't look like a right angle, but in Minkowski space, it is a right angle. T equals 0, t equals 1, t equals 1, t equals 2, and so forth and so on. So the character of the coordinates change from time-like to space-like when you go inside the horizon. And the Kruskal coordinate r and t continue into this region like so. But then you ask, where is r equals 0? Little r equals 0.
Where is little r equals 0? Little r equals 0 is a hyperboloid up here. It's a hyperboloid up here, which, if I remember, is at r squared equals minus 1. Capital R squared equals minus 1. Negative because it's in a time-like region here. That's where the singularity is, but there's also a singularity down here. R squared equals minus 1. R squared equals minus 1 has two branches. One of them in the upper half plane, one of them in the lower half plane. And that's where the singularities lie. That's where the Schwarzschild singularity is. It's bifurcated. There are two of them. And this whole geometry is the full extension. Of course, you can't go into the singularity behind the singularity. That's excised. This is excised. And the full extension, the full geodesic completion of the Schwarzschild geometry is this Kruskal plane with above and below these hyperboloids being excised. The outside of the black hole is the quadrant number 1. This region in here is called quadrant number 2, but it's not a full quadrant. It's the portion below the singularity. This is quadrant number 3. What the hell is that doing there? And then is quadrant number 4. That's the full analytic extension of the Schwarzschild metric. This is r, little r equals 2mg. And the surface, which is very close, r equals 2mg plus epsilon, is a hyperboloid, which looks like this. There's too much on this diagram. Can it be seen? Is it clear? I can, I think it's fairly clear. You see. Normally when I do this, I have 6 or 7 colors of chalk, but it seems not to have been 6 or 7 colors of chalk. All right, so the big surprise, although it's no surprise to anybody here probably, but the big surprise for physicists when they first discovered black holes was that the singularity was space-like, not time-like. The singularity is in some sense a time, not a place. Okay. That's the singularity. But that's not completely surprising, because if you go back to the Schwarzschild metric, behind the horizon, r becomes a time coordinate and t becomes a space coordinate. Incidentally, where is t? T is a coordinate behind the horizon here. T flows this way. T flows as a space-like coordinate. It flows from way back here to way up here, whereas r flows this way. It's a finite amount of proper time to the singularity, but at the singularity, the curvature invariants all diverge. The tidal forces diverge at the singularity. You would get stretched infinitely at the tidal force by the tidal forces at the singularity. Those are Kruskal coordinates, and as I said, their value is showing the global structure of the black hole. Let's see, we still have 5 minutes. I don't know whether to go into Penrose diagrams or not. I think I'll save that for the next time. And the next time what we'll do is go into Penrose diagrams. The construction of a black hole by infalling matter, and we'll find out that the majority of this diagram is unphysical. It's mainly only about less than half of it which really corresponds to anything. We'll construct a black hole by an informing shell of matter. Then we'll get into the wave equation. The wave equation in tortoise coordinates. And finally, we will derive the fact that black holes have a temperature. That black holes have a temperature and that they have a thermodynamics. That will be the goal for next time, and to work out the thermodynamic relations to the black hole. So that will all be based on one form or another of the coordinates that we've used up till now. Are there any questions? Was I infinitely clear? I think that means I was infinitely clear or infinitely opaque. And you get no questions, it means one of the two.
If you want a question.
Yes.
So why do you pay attention to quadrant number two, even if we can't get behind?
Oh, we can get behind quadrant number two.
But you can't get behind.
Sure you can, just fall in.
You.
Me? I can fall. If I find a black hole, I can decide to jump in.
No, you.
Me? You mean I'm too big?
No, I mean if we want to talk to each other still.
I can talk to you.
No, you couldn't talk to me.
Oh, yes, I can.
Your light rays wouldn't get out.
Oh. No. I thought I was throwing you into the black hole.
Okay,
you can talk to me.
Problem.
You can talk to me.
That's our problem.
Yeah, that's our problem. Yeah, you can never see me fall through the black hole. This is right. Okay, till tomorrow.